Today on EdgeFX.
You know, one sort of just rule of thumb is, does the city exist within the larger cycles on which it depends? Water cycles, air cycles, waste cycles, energy cycles. That's going to be the mark of a future city that shows respect and honor to the land that it exists within.
Geographer and wilderness guide Charles Carlin speaks with Gavin Van Horn, author of the new book, The Way of Coyote, Shared Journeys in the Urban Wilds. They discuss Gavin's work at the Center for Humans and Nature in Chicago, the role of modern mythology in our conceptions of urban spaces, and how an urban land ethic could dramatically change the terrain of cities like Chicago.
Well, Gavin, thank you so much for joining us today on EdgeFX. Really excited to talk about your new book, which is out this month from University of Chicago Press, entitled The Way of Coyote, Shared Journeys in the Urban Wild. And Gavin, why don't you start us off just by orienting us to this book, perhaps the project that it's part of, and how you came to construct this really interesting piece of work.
Sure. So I work for an organization called the Center for Humans and Nature, and it's a nonprofit group that looks at conservation in terms of ethics and values and philosophy. And we put together multidisciplinary projects, and one of those projects that I led was called City Creatures. And so that was looking at human relationships to non-human animals in the urban environment. And that was where the seeds of this book of mine got planted, because that was a group project, but the further I got into it and the more pieces I wrote related to that project, the more I saw it as also a solo project that would be a more personal journey of my own through the city, through my perspective and my coming to terms with moving to Chicago. So that's where the book started. And it evolved from there and kind of took on a life of its own as I wrote it.
And the book has this really interesting structure where you have interludes that are this sort of modern mythology where Coyote and some of the other creatures in the city get together and talk about what's happening in terms of development, how to interface with the humans whom they're trying to work around. And then you have another piece of the book that is dialogue with other scholars. You're talking with philosophers and with ethicists and with nature writers. And then there's a piece of the book that is really much more memoir. And like you said, sort of reckoning with having wound up in the city and not having your cabin somewhere out in the mountains or away from town. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how you decided on that structure and what those different pieces of the book do as it moves the reader through the argument.
So as I began to organize the essays, they sort of fell out according to a kind of theme. And the book took on a three-part structure. The first section is adaptation, the second section is called anima, and the third section is called conciliation. And so for the first section, adaptation, that was really about exploring kind of the remarkable ways that other animals have adapted to urban environments using sort of key species that have done this in different places and in Chicago as well, where I live, and my encounters with, say, coyotes or peregrine falcons or beavers. And then the second section is called anima, and that begins to dig a little bit deeper into not just what is here, but how are we connected. And it ventures into philosophical discussion, spiritual discussion, and it's called anima for a reason, because I sort of propose that there is an anima to the city, that in the sense of there is a connective tissue to life in the city that is sometimes beyond our physical perception, and that we pick up on this and that it basically flows through the city, and we can tune into that as human beings. The last section, conciliation, is my effort to start to kind of bring things together and say, okay, what are the large and small ways that we can look at cities as organisms that can adapt to the larger environments that they depend on. What role do we play in that? How can we bring things together in our own personal practice and on larger scales? Sometimes I say from the backyard to the bioregion. So that was a kind of effort to begin to reach not some conclusions, but at least make some suggestions about a sort of where to from here. Now, you asked about these, what to me became a very fun part of the book, were these little interludes where coyote and other species are personified. And at some point, it just became, I was reading about coyote, I was reading about trickster narratives, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to bring coyote into an urban environment? He usually isn't in those trickster narratives. A lot of them come from native traditions, and so the city doesn't figure very prominently, even though coyotes as a species have early on have been adapted to urban areas as far back as Tenochtitlan in central Mexico. But I thought it'd be kind of fun to do these urban folk tales and that sort of in short order capture the theme of each section. And so coyote with the capital C, as opposed to coyotes with the small c, coyote as a character with a capital C sort of leaps on the stage and provides a kind of introduction to each section. And then at the end of the book, I put Aldo Leopold, Lao Tzu, and Coyote with a capital C together, roaming throughout Chicago, sort of making sense of it all together. So in some ways, those were some of the most fun sections of the books of the book to write.
Yeah, I was really struck by having the book just sort of bookended by invoking Leopold, Lao Tzu, and Coyote at the beginning, and then having the epilogue to the book open with Aldo Leopold walking into a bar to meet Coyote before walking down to the beach.
I mainly wanted to do that so you could say, so Aldo Leopold walks into a bar, you know, like as though you were starting a joke. And, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time studying Aldo Leopold, his life and his work. And I also figured that for all that's been written about Leopold, probably nobody has ever had him walking through Chicago with Lao Tzu and a coyote.
I will say that was the first time I've encountered that particular setup. This modern mythology that you do with coyote and the other animals is a really interesting sort of reinvention of the trickster tale and this very creative way that you draw the reader into thinking about animals as part of the community with whom we live in the cities. And so in this prologue to Anima, Coyote calls a meeting of the other animals. And I was hoping you could read just a couple of paragraphs from that to give us a flavor of what that's like.
Sure thing. Okay. The moon was high in the sky when Coyote began to speak. Brothers and sisters, he said, thank you for coming. All of you know the benefits of living here, or you would not stay. There's good food, plenty of it for the smart and resourceful. There are places to sleep, homes for our children, water for drinking that never runs out. But, Coyote paused for dramatic effect, casting his yellow eyes upon the gathering. We must talk about the humans. Grumbles, a flapping of wings, and murmurs of assent rose from those gathered. Encouraged, Coyote continued. Few of the humans seek to find us. Few of them pay attention to us at all. They move as though we are not here. I do not need to work hard to be invisible. They look around and over me, down at small squares in their hands. They talk into the air, walk without stopping. And at first, I believe this was good, the best thing for all of us.
And so the story goes from there into the animals talking about how are we going to deal with these cars that just move through the city so quickly. And for me, as a reader, as I was moving through this book, I found myself always looking forward to these interludes and wondering who Coyote was going to be and what Coyote was going to say. But I wonder if you can just talk a little bit more about sort of invoking this figure of Coyote and this idea of anima, this energy that's in the city, and how maybe that draws the reader's attention or perceptive faculties to being able to think about all these other creatures as alive in this way.
Sure. So, I mean, one of the really exciting things about this book was to not just to think about what creatures are here, but think about these sort of deeper time stories that have been part of this continent from the beginning. I mean, Coyote, I think, according to Dan Flores, is America's oldest deity in terms of the trickster hero. And so, as you know, part of my personal journey was kind of looking at what is that deeper music? What are those enduring stories that live on beneath the surface, if you will, of the pavement? And so as I started to explore that and become intrigued by that, I started to think about how to actually, you know, put that on the page and write these sort of fanciful stories of Coyote as this trickster figure coming to the city and dealing with that, you know, first just deciding to come to the city when other creatures wouldn't, then in this passage, calling a council to try to decide what to do about the dangers of the city with the other animals. And then later on down the line, you know, him trying to remedy that situation through his own power. And as Coyote often does in these tales, he fails, but he succeeds at the same time. So it's it was a way of playing with those sorts of those anecdotes and also suggesting, I suppose, in terms of the question you just asked, is, you know, how does this fit with that larger idea of anima throughout the city? And I think maybe that's best summarized by using a kind of musical metaphor, like what breathes through the city that has always been here, that is still here, that may have been choked off at some points, that may have been bottlenecked at other points, but still is here for those who want to tune into it. What is that kind of deeper mythology that exists behind the gloss and gleam of aluminum and the solidity of concrete?
And your use of Coyote in that way, I think, sort of throws this book headlong into one of the great conservation debates of our time of, do we embrace our role as stewards or as managers of ecosystems? Do we learn to see the wildness and the wilderness in cities? Or there are those folks who argue, you know, a more traditional conservation approach of saying, this is evidence that our cities are disastrous, that they cause so much harm. And Coyote is, you know, one of these figures who physical coyotes have done really well in cities. And there's, as you say in the book, there are so many urban canid projects across the nation. You have one in Chicago. We have one here in Madison. Almost every major city has one. And at the same time, one of the reasons that Coyote has been so successful in moving across the continent was because of the extirpation of wolves, and that we were so successful in killing wolves across so many parts of the continent that that created some space for coyotes. And so there's this real tension in your book around sort of reckoning with what cities are, the prairie that doesn't exist anymore in Chicago, but at the same time trying to lead the reader in to seeing that that energy that is there and that wildness that is there behind the aluminum and the sidewalks. And so I'm curious just sort of your take on that tension and how you wrestled with that as you put together this book.
Right. Well, I think that is a core theme for this book, obviously. And I go back and forth and swim in sort of the muddiness of that. And in some ways, coyotes play perfectly into that, because I think that they challenge whenever we're tempted to create dualities between the city and the country, or the city and what we might think of as wilderness areas. Coyotes challenge those boundaries, and they are a boundary crosser. Actual coyotes are, and they also are as trickster figures. They're constantly sort of bumbling over or intentionally muddying boundaries. And so part of thinking about the city for me in this book is thinking about the ways that the city is connected to everything that happens in rural environments and the ways that rural environments and landscapes are intimately connected to the city, whether it's through energy flows, waste management, you know, all those great sort of cycles and systems that can be looked at in very sort of bland or mathematical ways. But there's also sort of a deeper thing going on there, at least in my mind. And that's where coyotes come in. That's also where I pull a little bit of the Tao Te Ching into this because of the yin yang symbol. So I don't think I come down in any particular, definitely not on any side of that, because I think we're always kind of in the muddled middle of not just humans over here, other animals over there, cities over here, nature over there. No, it's complicated and interwoven all the way through. And coyotes in some way, I think, alert us to that. You know, people think at first when they arrive in the city, in urban environments, you know, there's a sort of shock of what are these creatures doing here? This sort of medium-sized canid, wild animal, why would it be here? But there's good reasons for coyotes to be here, some of which you already mentioned, but, you know, availability of food sources, their survival rates, you know, are higher or similar to those in rural areas. So yeah, coyotes have become in some ways the quintessential urban adapter, the icon of an animal that has thrived in urban environments and continuously shows us that in some ways, or alerts us to these sorts of bifurcations or boundaries that we set up where we think humans own this place or this area, especially urban areas, and other animals can sort of be over there if they can make it. Well, coyotes mix and muddle those boundaries. And so for me in this book, as a person who's learning how to see urban areas as intimately connected along the landscape continuum to other areas, coyotes do a great job of sort of leading the way into that line of thought.
And you mentioned at the beginning of the book that being in Chicago was not your plan A, you know, that you hadn't thought of yourself as a city person. And, you know, is there there's a piece of this book that is memoir. And I wonder, as you talk to all of the folks who show you around the city and teach you about peregrines in the city or the coyote that dashes across the cemetery when you're on a walk there, you know, sort of becoming more aware of the wildness of Chicago through experience, how has that changed the way that you think about, you know, Chicago or even more broadly that, you know, that continuum of landscape that you were just talking about?
Yeah, well, that absolutely fits in to what we were just talking about, you know, recognizing that human beings are embedded in the landscape for better or worse. And I do think that it can be either or, that it's not necessarily that if humans are present, things are automatically degraded. I don't think that's true. I think that there can be mutual flourishing between other animals, wild animals, and humans in the same, sharing the same habitats. Well, we share the same habitats by default. And so part of being in the city for me is becoming attuned to those presences in a way and learning how to be on the lookout, to open my senses to the ways that other animals use the city as habitat. And the next step after, I think, becoming attuned to those presences is thinking about, well, if that's so, then how can we begin to have a role to and shape the city in a way that could be more welcoming to those other species? And that might be a leap for some, but I think it can be a gradual extension for others as they become, you know, entranced by these other forms of life that share this place with us.
And that question of what is our place, what's our role how do we relate to all these other creatures with whom we share our communities is so central to the book. And, you know, in this question, I wonder if I can, you know, call on the Gavin Van Horn, the seminarian, to think about, you know, our sort of the ethics of how we relate to these huge problems of climate change, you know, and oftentimes as we, as scholars, or as public figures debate climate change, there are some extremes that come up. So on the one hand, you'll hear folks talk about this idea that Earth will go on fine with or without us. Humans may not survive the climate catastrophe, but the Earth will. And so there's this sort of this sense of indifference. On the other end, you have Anthropocene boosters who really talk about the potential for technological manipulations of the climate and to manage Earth as this one giant garden, or even sort of a technological system. And yet, when you invoke Coyote, the trickster figure, you know, part of what you're calling in too is that sort of rich, you know, multinational Native American spirit experience where there are so many Native American traditions that have Coyote as a deity or as an important figure. And also something that's different sometimes in indigenous traditions is the centrality of humans, the importance of paying attention, of say welcoming the sun each morning or noticing the seasons passing, and this idea of humans being an integral part of ecosystems. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about where either this book or your thinking kind of falls into those debates.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts there. I mean, one thing, just picking up on the last thing you said, is that oftentimes in Native American stories or origin stories, humans are created sort of toward the end of things. And that's because we are considered the most vulnerable, the weakest, and that we have a tremendous amount to learn from other species and our animal kin. And so I think that's a perspective that I sort of wholeheartedly can get behind, that kind of humility. I think we could use a dose of that for sure. As far as the debate goes, though, I mean, a lot of times that just it pivots on what people's perspective is on human beings, you know, a kind of moral anthropology of like, are humans sort of by necessity defilers? Do they take and grab and are always sort of wanting more? Or are humans benign or even benevolent, you know, beings? Do they lean more one way or the other? And to me, you know, these various debates aren't very helpful. Oftentimes people have positions and they just further entrench themselves in that position. And I think to say a word about that in terms of argumentation, I don't find that very helpful. I don't think those types of direct arguments for one or for another get us very far, which is why I sort of advocate and subscribe and try to do in this book, you know, is write stories that offer an invitation to think of the world differently and a kind of fluidity rather than a position. Stories move and flow and we can sort of see our ways into them empathically. And in a similar way, you know, I think rather than these sort of grand debates, important as they might be in some context about climate change, for instance, I think there's a kind of movement and flow to our daily lives. And if the majority of people, which they are living in urban environments now, they have to find ways, points of connection for those larger invisible issues, or at least somewhat removed by degrees of separation in some cases, things like climate change, and find ways that those directly connect to their lives. So I was talking to Abigail Derby Lewis at the Field Museum. She's a climate scientist there, but she also is leading their project on monarch butterflies. There's a chapter in my book called A Question of Monarchs that talks about their long distance migrations and the difficulties and challenges that monarch butterflies face. So one of the cool things about this project for Abigail is there are groups in Chicago like Casa Michoacan, which is in the Pilsen neighborhood, predominantly Mexican American, and there's a very strong cultural connection to the monarch butterfly. So they've used the monarch not only its special cultural relationship to people coming from Central Mexico, migrating to places like urban environments like Chicago, and sort of drawing those parallels between people and butterflies. But it's also been a point of entry for them to think about climate change and the difficulties that the monarch butterfly faces. And so something that is deeply personal and cultural then gets connected to these larger issues that are facing us at this time. The reason I bring that example up is because if people are going to connect, and one of the points of writing this book about an urban environment and writing about non-human animals in particular is that if people are going to see these larger issues that can be somewhat obscured or invisible when you're talking about parts per million, you know, it's difficult to see those things, is that I think people can connect more readily to other animals, especially if they learn about those cultural connections, especially if they see themselves as personally having a relationship to those animals and sharing in some ways this urban environment and their story as being intertwined with the stories of these other animals.
That's an incredibly eloquent way to talk about that. You know, a lot of what you're describing there is it's almost like a sort of a phenomenology of wildness and then connecting to those larger, more abstract issues of climate change about how do these both the narratives that you tell and then the experiences that inform those narratives, how do they render the city and the world just perceptible in a different way?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, but isn't that what any piece of writing, I mean, hopefully is trying to do, is sort of shift, you know, use things that are familiar or recognizable and then invite readers to view them from different perspectives and to view them in such a way that they can be incorporated into their own lives and livelihoods.
Gavin, let's back up for a moment. And I'm curious, you know, how this book fits into some of the larger picture of your work with the Center for Humans and Nature in Chicago. Because I think Center for Humans and Nature fills an interesting space in this discussion about how we rethink our place in the world with respect to non-human creatures. There's a lot of attention given these days to science communication and trying to make, whether it's climate change science or the science of ecology, accessible to public audiences. And Center for Humans and Nature does some of that, but there's also a lot of discussion there around what I might call sort of public ethics or public philosophy and thinking about these questions from a more philosophical, spiritual, ethical perspective. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about, you know, how you all at Center for Humans and Nature have created that space, and perhaps, you know, what are some of the things that are working well? What are some of the things that are really hard to do about that?
I think that's a great question. I think you hit the nail on the head in sort of terms of what we are trying to do, which is to create a space and a platform for a public philosophy and a public ethics, specifically in terms of the relationship of human beings to the natural world. And some of us are fortunate enough to maybe get that at a university or in graduate school, if we kind of veer that direction. But there's not a lot of opportunity for that outside of an academic context. And so trying to hold that space open for people, I think, is one of our main missions, and to create conversation and dialogue around really big, complicated questions that don't always have immediate answers. And in fact, they don't have any one answer. They need the participation and the perspectives of all different kinds of people. And so that's the kind of environment that we try to foster there. And what was the latter part of your question, Charlie?
I think I was just sort of curious about what have you noticed about, you know, what that space has opened up in terms of sort of public engagement with those philosophical or ethical questions. And then, you know, also just curious about, like, what's been really hard about doing this work? What kind of roadblocks have you hit?
That's another great question and something that we really wrestle with as an organization, because although we get feedback from people who contribute to the discussions or who write directly for us and our publications or our website of how much they really appreciate that space to
to think through these things, to be in dialogue with other people, and how rare it is to have that space. One of the real challenges is knowing how that actually translates to people's lives on the ground. Like, you send these hopeful dandelion seeds out into the wind of the internet, and you wonder if they land. And, you know, how can you measure the change in a human heart? You know, is it an article that they read on your website, or is that just the cumulative effect of, you know, several different things that are going on in their lives, plus something that hit them just at the right time that really helped shift their point of view? But regardless of how difficult it is to measure that impact and to see it, I mean, obviously there are certain ways that you can see it. I mean, we've collaborated with people in performative spaces before. We host public events and co-host various types of public events that can be really powerful and give you some of that feedback of the ways that these discussions are affecting people's lives. But in general, you know, it is difficult to discern sometimes and to wonder, tangibly speaking, you know, how far you're pushing or moving the cultural needle in ways that are going to be really important for the challenges that we face nowadays. And, you know, not the least of which is just the basic, is beyond any issue, you know, whether it's climate change or endangered or species extinction or water quality. You know, the basic issue is our understanding of ourselves and our relationship to the natural world as human beings, and whether we're a part of that or whether we stand at some remove from it or consider ourselves somehow superior or dominant over other forms of life. And that sort of fundamental relationship is one that we, you know, work very hard to explore with other people, to open up those spaces where people can begin to see themselves or have reinforced, you know, how intimately we are connected to, you know, our every breath is connected to the natural world. So.
And I'd like to probe a little bit further into that question, you know, through a, you know, inquiry into craft. So, you know, you're trained as a scholar. You did doctoral work at the University of Florida in religious studies. You're a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary. And yet the prose that you're putting together, whether it's through the City Creatures blog or it's through this book, The Way of Coyote, in a lot of ways is trying to engage, at least from my reading of it, trying to engage a public audience. And so you're offering these somewhat playful tales of coyote, you know, while also asking folks to wrestle with big ideas from folks like environmental philosopher Val Plumwood or Gary Snyder's work at the intersection of Buddhism and deep ecology. And these are thinkers who have, you know, usually sat much more comfortably in scholarly debates. And so I'm hoping you can talk, you know, to us a little bit about, as a person putting together this book or putting together these blog posts, you know, how you sort of navigate that balance between creating a hook and an interest and a dialogue that a non-specialized audience can stick with, while also, you know, wrestling with some really dense theoretical issues.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, that is certainly been an evolution in my own work. You know, I mean, as you say, I come out of a pretty heavily academic context. And I think in some ways, I woke to the fact that I was writing for, in a very specialized language, in some cases for a very specialized audience, a very small pool of people who, with busy lives, may or may not get around to reading what I wrote. And so part of my challenge when I came to a nonprofit organization like the Center for Humans and Nature was really a welcome challenge, which was, how do I make this more, this really valuable work and thought more accessible to larger swaths of people? How do I make that invitation broader? Well, not, you know, you don't want to give up the depth of this stuff, but I think that there is room to personalize the narrative in such a way that people have more accessible entry points and can see themselves in the material in a way that's impossible to do while reading a very dry academic treatise. So yeah, that's very intentional. And it's also just a product of me becoming more and more aware of how important story is in our lives and the way that narratives shape our perspectives, sometimes even unconsciously shape our perspectives, but have more of an opportunity to, again, create a more conversational tone that people can more easily jump into. So, yeah, that's certainly been part of my own journey, is really shifting. And I think it's also an appreciation of the ways when I read a really good, like, I'm not going to pick up a book on, like, a hard book on astrophysics, you know, and just be swamped by formulas I don't understand, things that blow my mind without being able to at all wrap my head around it. But, you know, I might very well pick up a book by somebody like Malcolm Gladwell or, you know, a Bill Bryson or, you know, a David Quammen, who do such fine jobs of finding those sort of juicy nuggets and hooks and narratives that help us along as readers. You know, I admire that ability to, in some ways, that talent for translation of concepts that can be very heady into very accessible prose.
And that is certainly just a craft in and of itself.
Yeah, I think so. Perhaps some people have that gift, you know, but I think for most of us who are writing it, and most writers would probably agree that it's the day in, day out, really trying to not just think about yourself, but think about your audience. You know, how do you work on that craft and hone that craft? Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, Gavin, let's dive back into the meat of the book for a minute. Towards the end of the book, you circle back around to this idea of an urban land ethic. And you write that ethics can be a fearful word, saying it sounds as heavy as an iron doorstep. And yet you do lay out sort of your idea of an urban land ethic. And you introduce that by saying an urban land ethic, simply stated, is a practice of presence and care, intentionally seeking out what non-humans tell us about where we live and responding by tending to the biotic community we share. An urban land ethic consists of the small acts that occur in the backyard, rewilding practices at the neighborhood scale, and, if we are privileged enough to be in a position to do so, the large acts that make a city a place of flourishing within our larger bioregion. And as you write that, you also quote Aldo Leopold and his land ethic and Leopold's caution that the kind of collective thinking that a land ethic takes doesn't happen overnight. This isn't change that happens fast. And yet I wonder, if we speculate a little bit, you know, how might Chicago look in one or two or three generations if your idea of a collective land ethic were widely adopted?
That is a tough question. One way of answering that is by looking at other cities and looking at the models where, say, you know, certain progressive mayors have been able to move public transportation forward in innovative ways, or have there are certain cities that have barred cars from central sections of the city that have made, you know, pedestrian traffic not only friendly but preferable. There are other cities that, like Singapore, is becoming famous for its the way that it's weaving vegetation, not just at ground level but up vertically throughout the buildings that are part of that very urban city. And in some ways, these are all responses to the human. I mean, the studies are out there. I mean, human health improves dramatically when we have access to those green spaces. You know, some Richard Louv has called this vitamin N, based on, you know, I think earlier Dutch studies, that is vitamin nature. You know, some call it vitamin G's, vitamin green. And
So, you know, with that increasing recognition that our own human health, not just the health or well-being of other species, depends on these environments that incorporate green space and habitat and, you know, the basics, clean air, clean water, that those are cities that people want to live in, that there's a kind of positive feedback loop that goes on there as people enjoy those spaces and come to see themselves as, you know, parts of those spaces, then, you know, what can we do next? What can we do next? So, you know, to more sort of directly answer your question about what can Chicago be in 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, I think it would mean, I'll give you a kind of, you know, current example. The Chicago River, and this comes up several times in the book, you know, was just a mess for, you know, basically since European settlers arrived here. You know, it was a dumping ground. It was a way to get pollution, waste out of the city, send it away and don't think about it. And in many ways, that is the kind of attitude or perception that we have to actively counteract. We have to bring what could be invisible into visibility, you know. And now I'm happy to say the Chicago River, you know, is improving dramatically to the point where people are projecting that it will be swimmable in 2020, maybe 2030. I might be off on my decades there, but it's getting better and better. And wildlife are, as sort of a barometer of that quality, are thriving in that riparian corridor. So a city like Chicago, what can it be in 100, 200 years? It would have beautiful waterways, a cared for lake and river system. It would be aware of the watershed within which it exists, and it would treat those waters as with honor, if not as sacred beings. And that might be pushing it way too far for some people, but that's my language. It would be a city that would be depaved in favor of natural habitats. It would be a city that is interwoven with spaces through which to move through the city without fear of losing life or limb in terms of, you know, the kind of automobile traffic. In fact, it would be a city that deprioritizes automobiles in favor of slower modes of transport and public transport. And, you know, if we're dreaming here, I would see the city, you know, one sort of just rule of thumb is, does the city exist within the larger cycles on which it depends? Water cycles, air cycles, waste cycles, energy cycles. That's going to be the mark of a future city that shows respect and honor to the land that it exists within, is if it does those things, if it lives within those cycles, if it to some degree can be said to be self-sufficient or closed loop, that's the direction in which cities could head and should. And to do that will be the fruition of a full and robust urban land ethic.
That sounds like a city I want to live in.
I kind of do too, as I sit here describing it. Yeah, no kidding, right?
Well, Gavin, let's close.
Sure.
You, in your chapter, A Language That Transcends Words, you're talking about wolves, and you quote Kent Weber, who says the biggest lesson wolves can teach anybody, shut up and be quiet. And he says, wolves contemplate you. They don't look at you. They look right through you. And one of the things that I took away from reading your book was that, you know, this was a book that was almost a handbook of learning to perceive the city, learning to perceive the wildness and urban spaces, but also in that way, learning to be seen and to be perceived by all those other non-humans with which we share our places. And so I wonder, just as, you know, some final thoughts for folks that are going to be interested in and will sit down and read this book, what do you hope they might take from it? Or what do you hope they might do with having all of these essays in their hands?
Well, you know, you mentioned something at the beginning there about the wolf's stare that I think I can elaborate on a little bit. And I think that that's what's sometimes referred to as the mutual gaze. You said it's not just us looking at other animals, it's them looking at us. And that does resurface throughout the book. You know, I talk about a city full of eyes, that there are other animals that are watching us. I talk about the black-crowned night heron and its red eye watching and waiting to see if we'll learn how to adapt to the city. And in one of the essays, I talk about, you know, one of the most familiar birds around, which is the American robin, and how they're aware of our presence. They know how we move through the landscape, and we know this by the kinds of vocalizations that they make. And once you sort of tune into these other languages that are all around us, then you become aware that this is not just a monologue. You can treat it like just a monologue. And I think you end up seeing the sorts of impacts of that perspective. But what if we treated being in the city as a dialogue, as our being part of a larger conversation that's always ongoing around us, and that the awareness of other creatures and that they are perceiving us. And as we tune into their presences, we can soften our own presence in a way that is compatible or more compatible with their thriving.
Gavin, that's terrific. Gavin, thank you so much for joining us on EdgeFX today. Gavin's new book is The Way of Coyote, Shared Journeys in the Urban Wilds, and it's available now from the University of Chicago Press. So check it out, and you can also find Gavin's work over at the Center for Humans and Nature and the City Creatures blog there. Gavin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Charles Carlin, geographer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, speaking with Gavin Van Horn, Director of Cultures of Conservation with the Center for Humans and Nature. You can learn more about Gavin's work at humansandnature.org. You've been listening to EdgeFX, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment, and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode was produced by Charles Carlin, Brian Hamilton, and me, Sarah Thomas. The music you're hearing is by Julian Lynch. Stay tuned for episodes this fall featuring historian Nan Instad and feminist and environmental humanities scholar Astrida Niemenis. Get all of our episodes sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to the EdgeFX podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Radio Public, Stitcher, or TuneIn. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review. That really helps us connect with new listeners. And as always, keep up with a steady flow of great content about cultural and environmental change across the full sweep of human history at edgefx.net.